Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And, you know, one of the things that is most requested for a podcast topic is to discuss the temple. A lot of questions on its historical context and how it evolved and how it grew and what that's all about. Well, the biggest problem is that topic is much too big to cover in one podcast, and I don't even know how to bite it off. So we decided to start at the beginning with the Kirtland Temple, and I have two fabulous guests with me tonight. We're going to help walk us through the history and the context of the Kirtland Temple up to today. First of all, we have our old friend John Hamer. Hey, John, how you doing?
Hi, John. Great to be back.
Yeah, welcome back. And we have another special guest tonight, Barbara Walden. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, Barbara, you're connected with the temple. Why don't you give us a little bit of your background there?
I'd be happy to. I'm currently the executive director of the Community of Christ Historic Sites Foundation, and we're a foundation that supports the preservation and maintenance of all Community of Christ historic sites. There's 7 total scattered throughout the Midwest, from Joseph Smith III's Liberty Hall to Joseph and Emma Smith's mansion house, the Homestead, and the Kirtland Temple. The Kirtland Temple just happens to be one of my favorite sites. Before I became associated with the Historic Sites Foundation, I acted as the executive director of the Kirtland Temple. It was a wonderful site. We had between 35 to 40,000 visitors that would come from all over the world. Seems as though you could stand still and meet people from all over the world. I can think of very few places where you can do that. But while I was there, I helped train the historical interpreters and worked with the volunteers and had the privilege of being there when the new visitor center was constructed and dedicated in 2007. So that's just a little bit about myself.
Wow. Well, once again, welcome. And our old friend John, historian extraordinaire and map maker extraordinaire. anything else you want to add to that?
Well, I'm kind of in a way here along for the ride in terms of Kirtland Temple, since Barb is by far the expert. But I have, I'll mention that it's been a very special place for me. I went for the first time 10 years ago, and that's where I actually was introduced to Community of Christ. So I'd been a cultural Mormon. I wasn't a member of any of the churches since childhood. But the welcome that I received there, and that got me into really the Mormon history community and the Mormon historians community, and ultimately led to my fellowshipping with and joining Community of Christ. And it's just, I go back all the time. It's a special place. And with Barb, we wrote a book, or I illustrated, and she wrote a book called House of the Lord, The Story of Kirtland Temple. And we've also collaborated on a book called Community of Christ and Illustrated History. So Barb's been a partner in crime for all these things and just a wonderful collaborator.
Absolutely.
All right. So the Kirtland Temple, for most people who grew up in the Salt Lake branch of the church, is sort of a black hole of information. I mean, everybody knows it's there, and most people know it doesn't belong to the church anymore, but it gets sort of foggy. So most of the listeners to this podcast come from the Salt Lake branch, so I thought we might start at the beginning. Now, I'm gonna throw a curveball at you. Wilfred Wood, the famed Mormon artifact, the Indiana Jones of Mormonism, in one of his books, he wrote about that there was a temple, or at least the idea of a temple, in New York. Now, as far as you guys know, is Kirtland really the first attempt for the Mormon temple?
The actual construction and dedication, you mean?
Sure.
Or just the thought of building a temple?
Yeah, is this the first one that Joseph really attempted?
Well, one would say that the idea or the concept of a temple in Independence was happening. You also have the revelation that happens for the Kirtland Temple in December of 1832. So you can certainly say factually that the Kirtland Temple is the first temple that the Latter-day Saints construct and dedicate during Joseph's lifetime.
And obviously there is the concept of multiple temples, because really the commandment is happening almost simultaneously to build in Independence. But that temple, of course, doesn't get off the ground because of the saints getting driven out of Jackson County.
All right.
In terms of New York, I'm not aware of of a temple being, you know, of them even breaking ground or anything like that. I've never heard that. But if Wilford Wood found something, that'd be interesting.
Wilford Wood. I've never read anything about it either, except Wilford Wood has a picture that he claims is the cornerstone of the New York Temple. So I was just wondering if either of you had ever heard about that. I think it might be more fanciful imaginings from Wilford Wood, but there you go.
Well, it's certainly fascinating. I'd love to hear more of it. This is the first I've heard.
I'll send you a copy of the picture I'm referring to.
Wonderful.
All right. So the Curlin Temple, what was the revelation that actually got the whole thing started?
I would say that in December of 1832, there was a revelation to build a school for the church's ministers. And in combination, you had an impoverished community living there in Kirtland who desperately needed a meeting house. So that original revelation was about building a place where it would be a house of education or a house of learning, if you will. By 1833, they began breaking ground for a house of the Lord. Where the Kirtland Temple is located, and I really encourage you to visit the site, right behind where the Kirtland Temple stands today, the early Latter-day Saints built a schoolhouse/print shop. It was a two-story building where the first floor they used as a schoolhouse, and the second floor was a print shop where they printed their first church hymnal. They printed the Doctrine and Covenants there in 1835, and the second edition to the Book of Mormon in 1837. So they used that as a meeting house while they constructed the House of the Lord, what we would know today as the Kirtland Temple. That really all begins in 1833. They finally dedicate the temple by 1836. What I think is amazing about the construction itself is it's a small group of impoverished people living in hovels and shanties, as one person in 1836 described their homes, and yet they're constructing a 13,000 square foot house of worship, one of the largest houses of worship, certainly within their region. So it's just amazing to see a small group of impoverished people constructing such an enormous house of worship.
So why don't we start with a little description of the temple? For those of us who haven't been there, you know, what does it sort of look like?
Well, it's a three-story building, and it's a mixture of Gothic Revival and Federal-style architecture, a little bit of Georgian architecture. I once had an architect on tour who said, "My, this is a hodgepodge of architectural styles." And it really is. I think it's, in many ways, a metaphor for the Latter-day Saint community itself, which was a hodgepodge of believers there in Kirtland. As I mentioned before, it was a 13,000 square foot building. One of the unique aspects architecturally of the building are the upper and lower courts, two large rooms in the temple, which are about 55 by 65 feet that are stacked one on top of the other. Most houses of worship at the time would have a first floor sanctuary and a balcony that would help worshipers look over into the sanctuary. But in Kirtland, the revelation that Joseph Smith shared with the faith community was that there would be two areas, an upper court and a lower court, and that lower court would be devoted to worship, while the upper court was more or less that house of learning, which was devoted to education. There's accounts of 900 to 1,000 people literally packing into the lower court for the dedication service. It was an enormous sanctuary. Your average Methodist meeting house at this time could fit inside the lower court alone. In fact, you could turn it sideways, your average Methodist meeting house, and it could still fit inside the lower court. So the temple was wider than most houses of worship at this time were long, just an enormous building. So on that first floor, you have tiered pulpits. There's about 18 pulpits total in that lower court. A set of nine on the east side of the room and a set of nine on the west side of the room, and they represented the Aaronic priesthood, who were assigned to sit on the east side of the room, while the Melchizedek priesthood would sit on the west side of the room. These pulpits, I think for many people, are the element, the material culture of the temple that really stands out. And it's certainly a unique part of the temple. While in the upper court, you had desks versus pew boxes. And the idea of the upper court was that's where the school of the apostles would take place. It's where they would train missionaries who would launch out of Kirtland and carry the gospel throughout the world. While on the very third floor, you have five rooms that are exactly alike, long, thin rooms, and they were used for continuing education. The Kirtland High School used the third floor for reading, writing, and arithmetic, the basics. You also had the Kirtland, Ohio Theological Institution, the church's first seminary. They used the third floor to learn Hebrew grammar from Joshua Satius, who was a renowned Hebrew scholar. And you also had the third floor, one room set aside as Joseph Smith Jr.'s private study. That's where the headquarters of the church would have been from 1836 until many of the saints left Kirtland by 1839. So I could talk about the Kirtland Temple forever. I think I'll stop right now, though.
One thing on the size that I mentioned, maybe some of the listeners, they see the pic that they haven't been to the temple, but they see like a, in the, I don't know if you still have these, but like books of remembrances or whatever, and there'll be like a sheet that has pictures of all the temples, and it'll maybe start with Kirtland Temple, and it looks like a really little building compared to some of the later temples, because it looks kind of like a New England church, a little New England church. It looks like it's a little two-story building. But it's a deceiving when you just see a picture of it, because it's kind of built like a little building architecturally, but then it's blown up, so it's scaled up. And so if you actually see a cross section of it next to the Nauvoo Temple, say, you realize that this building is actually a lot bigger than it kind of looks. And then if you see an early picture of it next to, there used to be when it was built a Methodist meeting house that was next door to it, and when you see a little two-story church next to this building, you see how much bigger than just a little building it is.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up, because that's the way I perceived it. You know, I've always thought of it more like, say, the Brigham City or the Logan Tabernacles, you know, because they have the same sort of vibe, at least on the outside. But you say it's much, much bigger. I didn't realize it was that big.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not, I don't know how big the Brigham City Tabernacle is. So obviously later that people had there were more members and they were able to build even large tabernacles. But I guess I would say but if you take a cross section of the Nauvoo Temple and you say put that against the St. George Temple, you realize that the Nauvoo Temple was really quite large. And the Kirtland Temple, if you put it next to it, you would imagine it would be much, much smaller. But in fact, it's smaller, but it is still a very substantial building compared to what you'd imagine it.
Which is phenomenal because of the poverty at the time. I think, Barbara, you mentioned that, but there wasn't a lot of money in Kirtland. So the fact that they could do that so quickly at the time is simply amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everyone absolutely sacrificed to build and all their labor and everything like that to put everything into it. There's no doubt about that. And then at the same time, the church absolutely went bankrupt to make it. So they went on credit. They did everything they could to have enough money to build it. And in the end, the economy in Kirtland wasn't able to sustain that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think oftentimes for people, the Kirtland Temple is a symbol of the ultimate sacrifices of the early Latter-day Saints. I had mentioned there was a gentleman who was observing the Latter-day Saints in the 1836 as they were getting ready to dedicate the temple. And he has this incredible quote. His name is Truman Coe, and he was a minister from another church that was living there in Kirtland and was just fascinated with the Latter-day Saints. And he said that the women especially were giving up even the necessaries of life to build the temple. He said they were living in hovels and shanties. Very few of their homes were fit for human habitation, and yet they're constructing this incredible house of worship. At the time, they described the necessaries of life, what the women were sacrificing, as clothing and shelter, giving up food. And there's great accounts of the women inviting people into their homes and multiple families living in single dwellings, sacrificing the food of their families to feed the workers who were building the temple or clothing the workers. I mean, just incredible stories that I think are symbolized in this first temple.
Now, I think one thing that's really key about the temple, and we sort of hinted at this, you know, today in the Salt Lake branch of the church, after a temple is dedicated, it is sealed off to all but the most dedicated who have a temple recommend. That was never the case with Kirtland. Kirtland, as you mentioned, was always sort of an open house of worship and other function, right?
That's right. It was intended to be the center of community life. And as I mentioned, they had a high school that met up on the third floor. There are great accounts of them inviting ministers of other churches to use the pulpits to preach, and one account of a Unitarian minister taking advantage of that and preaching from the pulpits. So I think it was a hope for the Latter-day Saints that if we invite you into our house of worship to allow you to preach, perhaps you too would allow us into your house of worship to preach as well. It's almost the beginning of some ecumenical work there in Kirtland.
Now,
and they're also giving tours of the temple. I should point that out. Joseph Smith Sr. Was a pretty good guide. Warren Parrish was another tour guide at the Kirtland Temple. So they're recognizing that the building is kind of a curiosity, if you will, and people were dying to get inside to take a look. And so there's evidence that they were charging admission for the tours. And one of the highlights of the tour for one man, he paid to go back a second time, was to see the mummies that were on exhibit up on the third floor.
Yeah, well, now later those were in somebody's basement, but they were at the Kirtland Temple, right?
They were up on the third floor, wow. Yes. And there's accounts of them being on exhibit over at Joseph and Emma Smith's house and Frederick Granger's house. It seems like they had their own tour of the Kirtland area as well.
I do know that in the Nauvoo Temple, you know, Brigham liked to dance, so they would clear the floors and do dances. Were there any more secular activities like that that went on at Kirtland?
Oh, I can't say that we ever had a dance in Kirtland in the 1830s.
There's later accounts of dances in the second floor.
That's true.
But not in the 1830s time. But I think that even shows that the Nauvoo Temple also, you know, it like you say, has different uses and a different feeling for the people in Nauvoo in the 1840s than what LDS people are used to with the temples today. So the Nauvoo Temple, when it's built, it's built in a way based on the Kirtland model. So again, the major portions of space in Nauvoo are this upper and lower courts, and the interiors look, they're designed to look like the interior of Kirtland Temple with these multiple sets of pulpits. And ultimately, some of the LDS temples, the Salt Lake Temple, the Washington, D.C. Temple, some of the other temples have preserved a court that have these pulpit systems inside them. But this is the major portion of space in the first two temples. And then, unlike in Kirtland, in Nauvoo now, there starts to be this new kind of temple worship that gets added into it. But for the Nauvoo Temple, it's reserved essentially for the basement and the attic space. So in the basement, there is now the font, the baptismal font for baptisms for the dead. There is no font at all in Kirtland. That's not part of temple worship in the Kirtland period. And the same thing, this idea of the ritual endowment, it's very different from the Kirtland endowment, the Nauvoo endowment, which is though relegated to the attic or the third floor, the roof under the roof space in the Nauvoo Temple. Then later in the LDS practice, the central spaces of the temple get eliminated, and essentially the attic and the basement spaces become the temple.
Okay, that's a great segue into sort of the worship. So the Kirtland Temple actually predates the restoration of baptism for the dead, at least inside the building. Is that right?
That's correct.
At all.
So oftentimes the things we most associate with the temple, baptism for the dead and the endowment of the mysteries like Salt Lake does, come way after the concept of a temple came into Kirtland.
That's exactly right. So neither of those practices exist in Kirtland when they build the temple, and they wouldn't be associated with temple worship from the earliest saints. And so, in fact, they talk about a great endowment coming upon the saints when they complete Kirtland Temple. It's a promise that happens, and then it happens in the course of the dedication. But this kind of temple endowment is not a ceremony. It's not a ritual or a mystery or a secret. It's a it's essentially an outpouring of spirit. It's a promise that a gift will happen. The original idea that you will be endowed is you'll be endowed with a gift is essentially the original the meaning of that. And so that is what when we speak of a Kirtland endowment, it's a very different thing from the Nauvoo endowment.
And that's very difficult for those who are giving tours of the Kirtland Temple today. When a visitor asks, were there any endowments that took place here? It's difficult because the word endowment, as John has said, is used throughout the 1830s, but they're talking about something different than what later happens in Nauvoo. They're talking about this spiritual empowerment for missionary work. Now, they did do anointings on the third floor, and there was feet washings that were taking place. There were patriarchal blessings that were taking place in there, but not any of the endowments that we often connect to at the Nauvoo Temple.
So we do have the anointing and feet washing. How formalized was that? Was it as ritualized as later temple ceremonies were, or was it still sort of loose at that time?
Well, I would say that it would have to be way looser than at later times, because it becomes a system and it becomes a tradition and it becomes a process, you know. But initially, it's something that they're still feeling out. How are we going to? They want to restore all things, and one of the kinds of sacraments that you maybe can assume from reading the New Testament, you know, in addition to the sacrament of the Lord's Supper or communion, that's one of the things that Jesus does in one of the other Gospels. He, instead of having a supper, he washes the disciples' feet. And so feet washing becomes something that the saints also want to restore. And so that is something that is restored in Kirtland. And then some of the different traditions still maintain that. So for example, the Bickertonite Church, which is the church that descends from Sidney Rigdon's people, so that it's headquartered in Pennsylvania, that still remains one of their sacramental practices is feet washing, and they do it kind of based on this revival of feet washing that happened in Kirtland.
Well, others have made the argument that the current second anointing sort of evolved out of the feet washing. What's your thoughts on that, John?
You know, I'm not a real expert on LDS temple practices. I've heard that, and so I really haven't gone through and studied that, because there's a this isn't something that LDS people are real forthright with wanting to talk about it, and so I've generally respected that. I've never been involved in the LDS temple practices in terms of the endowment and everything like that, so I've read a certain amount of it, but I don't know all the details, I can say.
Fair enough. So now we talk about the pulpits, the 18 pulpits that were on either side, and I think, John, you mentioned that actually that's still a central architectural element of the Salt Lake Temple, and I encourage anybody who's on Temple Square to go see that new model of the temple that they've built there. You can really get a feel for how important that grand hall or whatever it is inside the Salt Lake Temple. So now, growing up, I always heard about the veil that would lower down over the assembly hall down there. Maybe you can talk about what was that all about?
Well, if you can imagine sitting in a sanctuary that has boxed-in pews, where during some of these Sunday worship services, you could have anywhere from 500 to 1,000 people meeting in the lower court. And the early Latter-day Saint community encouraged people to participate in the worship services. They believed in services being led by the Spirit. And if you had 500 people all in one room wanting to share a prayer or a testimony, you could imagine how long some of these services would be. So they installed veils, or what we would consider curtains, that hung from the lower court ceiling. And the plan was to have those same curtains or veils hanging from the upper court ceiling as well. And these heavy canvas curtains, one visitor described them as the sails of a ship, which were painted heavily white on both sides. And you had a curtain rod that was attached to the base of the curtain that would roll up with the curtain. So above your head, you could have a big, bulky curtain, or they could lower those curtains to divide the room into quarters. A set of curtains going right through the center of the room, and then another set of curtains dissecting that in half. And during Wednesday prayer and testimony meetings, which Joseph Smith Sr., the patriarch of the church, would preside over these services, he would send a priesthood member to every corner of the lower court to lead more or less their own prayer and testimony meeting. And that would allow more people to participate in worship. You also had the same heavy canvas curtains hanging above the pulpits on both sides of the rooms. And these curtains could be lowered through cranks that were located underneath each level of the pulpit. So the priesthood members could raise and lower the curtains as they wished, just like the members out in the pew boxes could. But these curtains would come down and divide off each level of the pulpits to give privacy to each level of the priesthood. And there are a number of accounts of private meetings taking place in the pulpits, of people kneeling down for prayer. I think one of the most well-known or famous accounts comes right after the dedication, when Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith kneel down for a time of private prayer. And as they begin to rise from prayer, they see the Lord standing upon the breastwork of the pulpit before them. An remarkable account that was recorded in Joseph Smith Jr.'s journal. And for many of our visitors, it's the sole reason they come to the Kirtland Temple, is to see the pulpits where that event took place.
Yeah, and that in the Salt Lake Doctrine and Covenants, that's section 110, I believe, where they saw Moses and Elias and Elijah and all that right there on the pulpit. So
that's right.
So they were more heavier than sort of the thin veil that you might see in the temples today, at least in the Salt Lake Branch temples.
Right,
they would be heavy. You could think of it as the origin of the, since they're somewhat utilitarian, so that you can divide it off for different meetings. It's the thing that has survived is in a meeting house, dividing the gym off from the chapel or whatever, those walls that are accordion out, you know, so more like that.
Yeah, and I think this is another one of those points of confusion, like the word endowment, because, you know, they talk about the veil in the Kirtland Temple, but it was more of a room divider than it served as the purpose of the veil in, say, the Salt Lake Temple.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we mentioned a little bit about the debt, and it's my understanding that a lot of the debt issues that they really got involved in were directly related to, or at least fed by, the building of the temple. And of course, they started the Kirtland Anti-Banking Society, and then Joseph sort of hightails it out of town in the winter of 37-38. So let's sort of pick up the story there then, because Joseph never returns again to Kirtland. So what happens with the temple? You know, there are a lot of people who are disillusioned, but they're still there. What's going on in the town at that time?
It's really a fascinating story. You have in 1838, while the Saints are still headquartered there in Kirtland, over 2,000 members living in Kirtland. But by 1839, considering the troubles they were having with the bank and the debt and just pressure from old members or former members of the church and those who are just living around the community, by 1839, there's only 100 Latter-day Saints remaining in Kirtland. And you can imagine just the sacrifice that took place to build the temple while maintaining a 13,000 square foot building is not an easy job for 100 people. Heating it alone was very difficult. So in August of 1838, there's evidence that they begin renting the second and third floors of the temple to the Western Reserve Teachers Seminary. And it was a place to train teachers. They used the second floor for training, and then you more or less graduated from the second floor to the third floor, where these new teachers were practicing their teaching techniques on local students. So it's neat to see that the temple continued to be used as a house of learning, even after many of the saints had left, and those 100 remaining behind continued to try and care and maintain the temple. Martin Harris was one who stuck around there in Kirtland. By the 1840s, there's evidence that the membership of the church grew to about 500 by 1842. But by 1844, when Joseph Smith and Hiram were killed in Carthage, the membership of the church was back down to 100. And then it appears as though from 1844 to the 1860s, whatever Latter-day Saint group that had keys to the temple was using the temple. After Joseph was killed, a number of people in church leadership contended for leadership of the church, and some of these groups returned to Kirtland, remembering that as a significant part of their church experience. Some of them were Zadok Brooks's Church of Christ, James Colin Brewster's group was there for a while, even Sidney Rigdon returned to Kirtland in 1846. There's a great account of him preaching from the pulpits to a standing crowd. So from 1844 to the 1860s, a variety of different Latter-day Saint groups go in and out of Kirtland using the temple. Some of those groups leaving and other ones arriving, it was a peaceful transition. Other times, not so peaceful, and the sheriff was called in to throw a group out while another group claimed to have ownership. By the 1860s, there's evidence of a Community of Christ group worshiping in the temple. And by the 1880s, there's a congregation that was established there and began working on restoring the temple back to its original splendor, is what they say. So by an 1883 conference, the Community of Christ decides that they're going to invest heavily financially on restoring that original splendor back to the temple. Some of that was theologically reinforced. They believed that they were the original church, the true church, and they felt that if they were going to worship in the temple, that true church ought to have the temple looking exactly the way it did when it was dedicated in 1836. So although the theology has changed much from the way the Community of Christ was in the 1880s and that fight to be the true church to where the Community of Christ is now, I, as a curator, am thankful that it was so important to them to have the temple looking exactly like it did. Some of the people alive in the 1830s could give accounts as to what the pulpits look like or what those veils look like. Thankfully, they did go back to that 1830s look 50 years after the temple had been dedicated.
So
does that answer your question?
Yeah. I know that there came a time, especially when the Brighamites were getting ready to head west, that, you know, Brigham was trying to sell the Nauvoo Temple and they were divesting themselves of other properties, ostensibly to try to raise money for the migration. Was there ever an attempt to try to claim ownership of the Kirtland Temple by Young and to sell it or do anything else with it?
Well, there are accounts of Brigham Young trying to, or his church, the 12, trying to sell the Kirtland Temple, but unfortunately they couldn't obtain a clear title. And it's difficult to sell a piece of property that you're not in possession of or that you don't have a clear title to. So they weren't very successful in trying to sell the temple. There's another account of Joseph Smith III in the 1860s attempting to sell the temple as well. It's interesting that even his mother had encouraged him to sell the temple in the 1860s, but he came across the same problem. He didn't have a clear title to the temple. And as he was working out that clear title, fellow church leaders convinced him that it wasn't his personal property, but rather should be the property of the church. And that really all happens throughout the 1870s.
So I guess my question now is, you know, I know there's been several insertions by the Utah church to try to gather in either the lost saints, you know, like when Brigham sent, I can't remember who it was, if it was Joseph F. Smith or whatever, to try to bring in, you know, Martin Harris and Oliver Cowdery. And I know they tried to collect some of the old artifacts. Yeah, I guess my question is, what was there really any attempt by them to really circle in and get the Kirtland Temple back? I could just imagine that the 12 in Salt Lake, the fact that they didn't have it all those years sort of bothered them.
You know, I don't think that there was any attempt from them to get it back. For one thing, there for a whole long period of time, all the way up until, you know, almost even World War II, but not quite that long. But anyway, into the 20th century, the LDS Church didn't have a lot of presence outside of the Great Basin in the rest of the U.S. And so owning the temple, which is quite a big thing, you know, big building to keep up and everything like that, would actually be costly without a lot of point to it for people who aren't living there. And so actually, I don't think that there was an attempt to get it back in terms of like getting other people, you know, gathered in. So when the guy who went, goes and gets Martin Harris, I think it's almost a private venture. He just has met Martin Harris. He's sad that you know, he isn't living well. And so he is able to pay his way to Utah, where he ends up living with relatives for the last years of his life. But I don't think in a lot of ways, there isn't an ability to gather a lot of the Midwestern saints, because they're the people in the Midwest, the people who have stayed there, are so opposed to polygamy. And so this is kind of has been an irreconcilable point of difference in the 19th century between the Midwestern and the Western Mormons.
I agree with John. I'm not aware of any accounts of the Mormon Church trying to buy the temple back in the late 19th century. There are accounts of them visiting the temple and having a tour, and some of these were very contentious tours where theology was debated back and forth, and that went in to the mid-20th century. It's also very difficult to buy a building that's not for sale, to be frankly.
Yeah, there, especially around the turn of the century, there was a lot of bad blood. I'm thinking of like the letters between Joseph F. Smith and Evans, that they they published under the Blood Atonement and the Origins of Plural Marriage, and it seems like there was sort of a kind of a heated Cold War going on between the two. At least maybe that's the way the Salt Lake people saw it.
Absolutely.
No, that was from both sides, you know. So there's this moment when Joseph F. Smith is the president of the LDS Church, and his cousin, first cousin, Joseph Smith III, is the president of the RLDS Church, and they do not, you know, get along well. They have, they haven't, you know, when Joseph III had gone out earlier to Utah to preach to dissenting Mormons there, he didn't feel that he was well treated, and that Joseph F. Smith was, he felt assigned to kind of dog him around and preach against him, and specifically also to preach against his mother. So lots of things were said about Emma being a terrible woman and a liar and all kinds of things like that. And that made a lot of just even a personal family relationship. But in this case, it was a personal family where the family members are, you know, cousins here are in fact the presidents of the two churches. And so it's kind of a family feud that is also a church feud. And there were a lot of hard feelings at the time.
Yeah, I can imagine. So we got up to about the 1880s talking about the temple. So does the temple stay in continuous operation all the way up to present day, or does it fall into disrepair?
Well, in the 1880s, there was a great effort in restoring the temple as well as preserving it, a great maintenance effort that took place by the Community of Christ, who at the time was the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the congregation that began meeting there in the 1880s continued to use the temple as a house of worship and a place that they gathered weekly until the 1950s. Wow. And then in the 1950s, they constructed a meeting house or a chapel across the street from the temple. And that's where their regular activities would take place. The Wednesday night services, the potlucks, recreational activities, as well as worship activities. And in doing that, they recognized that the temple was a historic house of worship and should be used on special occasions. The leadership of the church, not only for the congregation, but for the world church, for the whole community of Christ, strongly encouraged the congregation to move out of the temple, that by using it on a regular basis, they were adding to the wear and tear. And when they moved out in the 1950s, then another wave of restoration efforts took place to restucco the temple, to replaster, to better maintain the temple on a long-term basis. So that begins in the 1950s, and today the temple is still a very significant house of worship for the Community of Christ, where they hold special worship services. Congregations coming in from out of town will reserve the lower court for a special worship service or communion service. In the 1990s, we also opened up the temple for other Latter-day Saint groups who were traveling through Kirtland. They would have the opportunity to reserve the temple like we'd allow Community of Christ groups for all those years. Then we opened it up to our Latter-day Saint cousins. So members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, oftentimes their leaders will contact the site director there in Kirtland and reserve the lower court for a sacrament meeting. We've had Relief Society worship services take place there, as well as groups that come from the Strangite Church or the Restoration branches, even the Remnant Church, which is headquartered in Independence, Missouri, has worship there. It's really wonderful to see all these different Latter-day Saint groups who, although they disagree theologically, to see them appreciating the history that we all share and to worship in the lower court. We have 50 to 60 worship services that take place there in the lower court every year. And I'd say only about 30, maybe 35 are Community of Christ groups.
So
I was there just last month, and it was for a Remnant. The Remnant Church was having a annual, you know, semi-annual conference, and they were having it their priesthood meeting in the temple as a retreat. And in fact, they had done all the leadership of the church was there, and they had spent the 30 days trying to prepare themselves for, again, this kind of special endowment where we're talking about a Kirtland endowment, where they would be endowed with power in order to further the work of the Remnant Church in terms of reorganizing efforts and rebuilding efforts.
I should also add that Kirtland, the community of Kirtland, has a great tradition of having an ecumenical Thanksgiving service in the Kirtland Temple every year. It's the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, where the Kirtland Ministerial Alliance, which is a collection of civic and religious leaders of Kirtland, they get together every month, but in November of every year, they have an ecumenical worship service where the high school choir sings from the historic choir lofts, and the new minister to the Kirtland area preaches from the pulpits. And so it's just a Norman Rockwell experience. You're sitting there in a pew box, and one year it's the new Catholic priest preaching. Another year it's the Unitarian Universalist minister preaching. You'll have the Kirtland Schools superintendent offering the invocation for the worship service and the director of the LDS Historic Kirtland giving the benediction. It's really an incredible experience, and it reminds me of in the 1830s how the Latter-day Saints would invite ministers of other Christian denominations to worship or preach in the temple. In many ways, you feel like you're returning to that 1830s period.
Yeah, I think the temple, the Kirtland Temple, is really such a stark reminder of the theological shift that happened between, you know, that Kirtland period for Joseph Smith and then what later came in Nauvoo and then in the early days in Salt Lake City. You know, and Joseph was very much more, less secretive and more open with the belief in the church. And I think those two temples, say comparing Salt Lake Temple to the Kirtland Temple and how starkly different they are, really speaks to that theological shift.
Absolutely. I mean, there obviously was a major, there was major changes going throughout the entire early period. So people who, like David Whitmer, who joined before the Book of Mormon was even published, there was a very different Mormonism that he was originally attracted to than anybody who would have joined in 1844, where now suddenly the church had grown and changed and all kinds of new things had been restored and there had been changes in the practices. In Salt Lake Temple, you mentioned that how before you had mentioned how there are things that are remembered from Kirtland that still are there, like this inner court that has the pulpits. The other interesting thing that I just love about the Salt Lake Temple is that the interesting feature of it is the exterior towers, where there are the six towers, each of them are multi-tiered. You know, where they each have three tiers and they're on the east side and the west side. That is an external representation, essentially, of the pulpit arrangement. So you take the pulpits, this is the most interesting feature of Kirtland Temple, and now that's put on the outside. And so in a way, the Salt Lake Temple has that homage to Kirtland.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and it's interesting to hear you all talk about the architectural mishmash, because I mean that's what the Salt Lake Temple is so often, you know, accused of, with the battlements and the towers and the stone, and it's just everywhere on the board. So it's interesting to hear that that's been a long running theme.
Well, the other thing that's happened then too, with the between Kirtland and Nauvoo, there's this idea of not just restoring the priesthood, which is the first thing that gets restored, and then restoring the church, but then the lathe development in Nauvoo is the restoration of the kingdom. And that again is done in a secret way. So the kingdom of God on earth is in the secret council of 50, but then this imagery of the restored kingdom appears. And so it wouldn't have probably made a lot of sense even in Kirtland time period to have done something that looks kind of like a castle. But then when you get out to Utah, you know, after you've restored kingdom and you have this major kingdom metaphor going, then the temples have crenellations. They have all these different aspects to them that are reminiscent of, European castles.
Yeah. And, you know, on that note, you know, one thing I find fascinating, especially in the early days of the church, is the tension that the church has with the Protestant world around it. And also, you know, the idea that it's the only true church, it's the restoration, and it's a separation from that same Protestant movement. But you get things like the Kirtland Temple that look very much, the way things are set up. They borrow quite a bit from American worship service, but then they go take it their own with all of the, for example, the multiplicity of pews, of pulpits.
Yeah, and interesting. I mean, the Kirtland Temple has so many things that, like the pulpits, that are different. But then, what I love to do when I get to go to Kirtland is we drive around to the little towns all around, and if you go to see other churches from the 1820s, 1830s, it's surprising how many churches there are around there that are so reminiscent of Kirtland Temple. There's all of these, you know, this, we described it as an architectural mishmash. Well, everybody was building vernacular stuff out of pattern books and other ways that this is all the people they wanted to have revivals and everything like that of old architecture, but they aren't architects. And everybody is building buildings like this, even if they're smaller but there's so many different elements that you'll see all around. So they are very aware of, you know, what other people are building, and that's, you know, where they're getting the ideas from.
Absolutely. I think you can walk through the lower court of the Kirtland Temple, and if you have in your hand a Asher Benjamin book from 1806 or from the 1830s, it's like you can point out all of the patterns from Asher Benjamin, who is like the 19th century Bob Vila, that are right there in the temple. It's like they're more than happy to take plans and pattern books in the same way that they're more than happy to take the traditional hymns from the Methodist Church and change some of the wording around to match the theology of the Latter-day Saint Church. What they do with their architecture, they're also in many ways doing with their hymnody and their theology, and they're very much part of their context.
Well, and I guess that's one of the strengths of Mormonism, especially from Joseph Smith, has always been that willingness to create a mashup, to take what he sees and what he enjoys. You know, he runs into Freemasonry in Nauvoo, and he brings it right in. And I really think that's been a strength of the theology and one of the reasons it's survived.
Right. It makes it so fascinating, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So Barbara, having spent so much time in the temple, what is your favorite aspect of the temple?
Oh, that is a tough question. If I must confess, one of the things that I enjoy doing the most, especially when I was the site director there in Kirtland, is in the early hours of the morning, or even sometimes at sunset, to go into the Kirtland Temple all by myself and just sit in the lower court, to open up one of the pew boxes and go inside and sit down and just breathe in that lower court, you know, to look around and look at the decorative artwork or the decorative woodwork, the arch that goes above the Melchizedek pulpits and the guilloches, the traveling decorative woodwork that goes around the pulpits, all the intricate detail, and just think about all the people who have been through the temple and who have left their stories there for us. You know, I think about Brigham Young and some of those early carpenters like Jacob Bump and Truman Angel, and the amount of work that they put into constructing the temple, But it also makes me think of William Kelly and E.L. Kelly and the workers of the 1880s who worked in many ways just as hard to preserve it. And then you can't help but think of what takes place there now and the congregations that travel from all over the world to hold a worship service there in the lower court and to sing the Spirit of God. After 8 years in Kirtland, I am not tired of that hymn in the least. That is one of my favorite hymns. But to also think of, you know, when the Catholic priest preached from the pulpits in 2002, or think about the high school choir singing from the choir lofts, you know, last fall, there's just so many powerful stories that are within those walls, not only of the people of the 1830s and their sacrifice, but also the people who come, who feel a sense of calling to be within its walls, who still feel like it's sacred space. I think for the community of Christ today, they take the stewardship of that building very seriously, not only because it's a beautiful building architecturally and it's a National Historic Landmark, but also paying respect to the people who had sacrificed to make the building what it is today. Not only out of respect for Joseph Smith and Emma Smith, but also for the people that travel the thousands of miles to really appreciate the story of the house of the Lord.
Yeah, you know,
my sermon's over. Thank you for listening.
Well, it's such a physical connection to the early church where much of it was just lost. You know, the what they built up in Missouri, much of Nauvoo was destroyed, and it's just such a physical sign of what was still there. You know, one of my ancestors was Vincent Knight, who was, you know, one of the Joseph Smith's confidants at that time. And there's a family story. I don't know if it's real or not. Maybe you can confirm at least one detail of it. During one of the meetings they're having the temple when the Kirtland Bank was going bad, you know, people would get up and start yelling and screaming and accusing. And according to the his daughter's journal, Vincent picked somebody up and threw him out the window of the temple. Is that even possible? Can you throw somebody out the window in the Kirtland Temple?
There's a lot of windows, so plenty of opportunities to
do that. Those
were heated times.
Yeah, and good old Vincent helped smuggle them out when they left in January. So maybe the last thing I'd like to sort of cover is because of the way the temple service has been shaped in the you know, the Salt Lake branch of the church, I think a lot of Salt Lake Mormons are confused sort of about the role of the temple and how exactly the Community of Christ thinks about the temple. So maybe what I'd like to do is sort of, you know, close out with framing that. How does the Community of Christ view the temple, and what is the role of the temple in general, and then for the Kirtland Temple in their theological beliefs today?
Well, John, how would you like to field the theology part of that question, and I can field how it's used today?
I would say that, again, that the, like we kind of talked about, that early Mormonism was a moving target, and there's a lot of things in that wonderful theological grab bag of those first 14 years. And different churches, there's a couple hundred different Latter-day Saint tradition churches, and different ones emphasize different parts of that tradition, and they pull different things out. And so I wouldn't even say that nobody can do it all, and different people emphasize different things. And so in the same way that there is multiple things going on in early Mormonism, there were multiple ideas of temple worship at different times in early Mormonism. And so for Community of Christ, probably because of the possession of Kirtland Temple and the stewardship of Kirtland Temple and having our general conferences, world conferences in Kirtland Temple, there's always been, you know, that connection with the Kirtland form of temple worship. And so when the revelation came in the 70s and 80s to build, there were preparatory revelations, and then in the revelation in the 80s to build the temple in Independence, finally build the temple in Jackson County, the theological idea of it was to look more towards the Kirtland example. And so just from that early revelation that is in both DNCs and the LDS DNC as well, where the temple is going to be a house of worship, a house of learning, a house of order, In the same way, the Temple in Independence is viewed in those ways, where it's a place where there are very special worship services, where the whole community can gather together, build community, commune with the Creator. And then there is, it's also, though, a house of learning. And so the archives and the library and temple schools and other kinds of seminars and conferences, training conferences, are all held in the temple in Independence. And then also, just like in Kirtland, where the Kirtland Temple is the headquarters of the church, the Independence Temple is the headquarters of Community of Christ. So this is where we take this house of order, where the leadership meets, where special conferences are held again. So what I'd say for all those things, the Independence Temple builds on that part of the early Latter-day Saint model of temple worship. And then the other thing that is in the Revelation in the 80s that we end up building the temple in Independence is that the temple will be specially dedicated to peace. And so there's a long-standing tradition in Community of Christ where we look back on our heritage and all of the problems we had with the Gentiles, with neighbors, the Mormon War in Missouri, the Mormon War in Illinois, getting driven around, driven out. There has been an attempt to, instead of where we arm ourselves and we march on Zion's camp and we take everything back by force, there's an attempt instead to embrace peace, make peace with our neighbors, and so the temple is specially dedicated to peace. And so every day, also, one of the things that's done in the temple in Independence is there's a daily prayer for peace where a candle is lit and a special place is designated, either a country or a indigenous people that isn't able to be free in its own country or something like that, where a special prayer is said for peace in the world.
Wow, interesting. And Barbara, the temple today. So I think.
Oh, the temple today. I think the temple today, just as John described about the Independence Temple, we reach back into our past and we try to have the Kirtland Temple continue to be that center of community life and a house of worship, a house of learning, a house of prayer. Some of the events that have taken place there as a house of learning, we've hosted the Mormon History Association in 2003 and the John Whitmer History Association in 2007, which was a great gathering of history enthusiasts. But also in 2007, they hosted the Communal Studies Association, which is a group of scholars that enjoy studying 19th century utopian experiments as well as 20th and 21st century experiments. And to be in the lower court, and John Hamer was there, to be in the lower court where over 200 people were packed inside, about 40 of those were a group of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who were on a tour from Vermont all the way through Ohio with Carl Anderson. To have this group of 200, including that small group of LDS members, singing in a hymn festival where they sung Shaker hymns and harmonist hymns, and we ended the hymn festival with Redeemer of Israel and the Spirit of God. Just incredible experiences in worship as well as a celebration of history. The third floor in the 1830s was used as a place for the church leadership to meet on a weekly basis. And it wasn't too long ago that the Community of Christ presidents of 70s also met up on the third floor for a time of leadership and concern for the church and for their positions individually. So it continues to be used as that place of learning and prayer and fasting, just like it was in the 1830s, where we invite all different Latter-day Saint groups to come and celebrate that shared history. As we had mentioned before, there have been divisions and have been confrontational moments there at the Kirtland Temple between the Latter-day Saint groups. And it's so nice to know that those times are no longer, and that we much rather celebrate what we have in common versus what divides us. So it's really a place that memorializes the early saints as well as where we are today. I really encourage all of your listeners to go and visit the Kirtland Temple or visit any of the Community of Christ historic sites in Nauvoo or Lamoni or even in Independence. They're always welcome there, and we recognize that we have a wonderful shared history.
Yeah, definitely. And the one experience I've had is with the temple in Missouri, and the tour guides there were intelligent and welcoming, and I just had a wonderful experience there. I haven't made out to Kirtland yet, but I intend to.
And well, if I can put in one plug for you as a Vincent Knight descendant, right around the corner from the Kirtland Temple, the Vincent Knight home still stands, right on the corner of Joseph Street and Cowdery Street.
Yes, my mom has told me that. I really need to get out there. So I really would like to. And John, you know, every time you come on, you almost convert me to the Community of Christ. So
I'm going to get you.
You know, last time you were on, I actually had several people send me emails who had actually gone to services. So you're doing the Lord's work, I guess.
Thank you very much.
I have to ask one last thing, or all my ex-Mormon friends will poke me in the ribs. So there is almost an ex-Mormon mythos that, you know, during that sort of second Pentecost that we talked about, when there was the blessing of the temple, and, you know, a lot of people described the same rushing of wind like you hear it described in Acts, and people saw angels and all that. There's an ex-Mormon mythos that everybody had been fasting and drinking a lot, and, you know, it was sort of a alcohol-infused mass hysteria. So I actually have no idea. I've never read anything to suggest that. I want to hear both of your takes on that.
They were fasting. It wasn't uncommon for the early saints to fast on Sunday, and they were encouraged to give to the church where they would usually give for food and other necessaries of life there in Kirtland. All sorts of accounts come out of that period, and one of the early saints liked to say, well, you remember that in the New Testament, the same accusations of drinking were said of Jesus and his disciples.
That's true.
So I'm not eager to believe that any accounts like that. I think that they were genuine. I think they were praying and fasting and expecting an empowerment from on high. And I really, really admire that.
Well, Barbara, I tend to agree. I'm pretty secular in my views, but one thing I do believe is that most people sincerely believe their own religious experiences, and that they're meaningful and real to them. So, yeah, I'm not inclined to take that away from the early saints either.
Sure.
I will say that one of those accounts is actually from my people in my family. So my great 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 uncle is one of the ones who makes that accusation. So there are people who said that, but anyway, but I agree with what's been said.
All right. Wonderful. I'll have to head up now. It's so those of us who don't know, it's just outside of Cincinnati. Is that right?
No.
It's about 6 hours from Cincinnati.
Well, okay. Where, what's
Cleveland.
It? Cleveland. That's right. So it's about a couple hours from the center of Cleveland, right?
Well, it's about 25 miles east of Cleveland.
All right. See, I don't even know where it is. So don't listen to me. Isn't that Amish country? Isn't that Amish up there?
Oh, yes. There's an Amish community just south of Kirtland.
The largest Amish community in the country. And we were just driving around the Amish countryside last month, and we were behind half a dozen buggies. You know, so it was incredible, the number. It was a Friday night, and there were the young Amish guys were out on the town sitting again, you know, against the watering hole, kind of watching the cars go by.
All right. Well, wonderful. Barbara, John, thanks. It's been a great enlightening experience for me. And I'm going to have to put it in my plans to get out there.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you again for the invitation. This has been quite enjoyable, and I look forward to doing it again.
All right. As always, the discussion continues on the website. You can find us at mormonexpression.com, or you can call us at the number that I don't remember.